But those chairs, were they straight up like hardwood and stuff like that, or were they like?
They were constructed out of number two pine, just a 1x4 pine. I weighed the chair. It was 24 pounds.
Wow.
It's hard to explain, but we ended up both of us wearing the chairs by having the armrests on our chest and what would be the seat of the chair on our backs with our backpacks on. And I'll speak for myself. I don't think the summit steward was enjoying it quite as much, but it was an absolute perfect fit. They just slid right on. They sat there on the chest pads, and we didn't take a break. We just motored out of there.
Wow. I was
It was a funny sight. There's no photo, thank God, but it was a funny sight.
The bushwhacks were some of the worst days I've ever had in the mountains, or life, really.
Whereas Panther Mountain is totally opposite. It's a mountain on top of a crater.
I think the weather challenges on this incident were particularly difficult.
It is really the development of New York State. Catskills were responsible.
Now you're listening to Inside the Line, the Catskills.
All right, since we're already reporting, usually I just talk about crazy stuff. So, of course, coming up October 1st, which is the day after where this is going to be released, is hunting season. Is that bear hunting season, correct?
Yeah, we're in early bear season now.
Okay, yeah. So wear your orange. Get your orange out there. I don't know. What do you guys think of the bear bells and stuff like that? Do you think that that's not really needed here?
One of the personally most, I don't want to say frustrating, but it's something that causes me to shake my head when I hear one in New York State. Bear bells, and for that matter, mace or bear spray are kind of a little bit overkill.
Yeah.
In my humble opinion.
Yeah, we certainly hear about a problem bear once in a while. There's a bear, I think, on Plateau up in Greene County that was, you know, maybe a little bit less shy than other bears. But, I mean, they're everywhere in the Catskills. You don't see them because they avoid people. They take off. They run. They're skittish. I mean, most bears you see the tail end of them taking off through the brush.
Yeah. I met some ladies, I believe I was hiking like Balsam Lake, and they had like at least three or four on each of them. And I'm just like, that is a little bit overkill, guys, don't you think? And they're just like, we just don't want to be attacked. And I'm like, pretty sure there's like a one in a gajillion bear attack up here in New York State. So it's a little crazy, but you don't have to wear bear bells. Mace, man, I've never heard of mace. I had to carry bear spray up with me and the Canadian Rockies, of course, and little experience. I actually brought that over the border, which is illegal. You guys aren't going to arrest me, are you?
No.
Okay.
Potential limitations or something.
I couldn't believe that when we went back over to America, they didn't see it, and it was right on the top, and it was available, and I was just like, oh, pretty cool. And I spent like $50 on that. I get my $50 worth it, so I'll never probably use it again. But anyway. October 1st, January 1st is hunting season, so start wearing your orange. You should be wearing your orange anyway if you're bushwhacking and stuff like that, just in case. Also, we're in the category of bears. Did you guys hear about that man who faked the bear attack in the Shenandoahs to get rescued?
I didn't hear that one, no.
Yeah. So, an Ohio man was charged with falsely reporting an incident after investigators say he called authorities to report a bear attack just to get out of a wooded area in West Virginia. So it looks like he was assisted in the woods, and they said he cried, "Please help me," over the phone, and was being attacked by the bear. So of course, the rangers down there, sheriff's office, other people ran in. He allegedly claimed that he had been walking for days, his phone was dying, and that the bears were circling him and he was going to die. So this guy was 47 years old, of Ohio. Called several search rescue groups, emergency lights. They started to get the helicopters because they thought he was in danger. And then all of a sudden they found him kind of like screaming and yelling. And when they found him, he was just sitting there. And he's like, I guess he just was like, hey, how you guys doing? They're just like, where's the bear? And, you know, everybody had everything ready to get to go and stuff. And they're just like, oh man, I just wanted to get out of the woods and I was getting dark and just needed some assistance. And, they walked him out and instead of like cuffing him and stuff like that, but they put him in the car and told him that you're going to be arrested and charged for falsely reporting an incident. So pretty crazy.
I would certainly say that, you don't need that elaborate of a story. If you need some help in the backcountry of the Catskills, we'll come help you out. Certainly plenty of, broken ankles that suddenly are miraculously heal when you give them a bottle of Gatorade and a snack and all of a sudden they can walk out. Yeah, we've seen it all.
Yeah. Well, have you seen a fake bear attack yet?
No, I haven't seen that one. It's new.
Yeah. I remember some of your stories. You know, we got the DEC Wildlands course from you guys and you told some pretty crazy stories of, you know, just once again, something happened in the woods, you guys have to stay overnight and all of a sudden the person is fine the next morning. And I could imagine that look on your guys' face of just like, really, really, but hey, I guess it heals overnight. But
I think a lot of the backcountry stuff is just that panic that sets in when people out of their element realize that they're 3.5 hours from their car and there's not an easy button and it's a new feeling for them. And yeah, like I said, a cold Gatorade and a snack have healed a lot of injuries over the years for us.
It does. Yeah. And, you know, once again, you do have that fear of the sun going down. And a lot of people don't realize how freaking dark it gets when the sun just grazes over those trees and starts settling down. It gets really dark and people don't realize and panic sets in. And then all of a sudden, you know, you think that you're going to be hunted or something like that. You hear a tree branch break and then all of a sudden even more panic. You're just like, bears are going to kill me. And then you call the law enforcement and all of a sudden they come up and nothing's happened. So, but yeah, usually I have a bunch of stories. I heard, you know, a couple of weeks ago that rescuer or that guy that was in the deep in Italy in the cave was rescued. He's actually from New Jersey. He was rescued out and he was 3,400 feet down into a cave and they had a bunch of people from New Jersey go up and help rescue them. They had like, I read they have over 200 rescuers down in there to rescue this guy that was apparently feeling ill, had like some vomiting, blood vomiting. So of course it escalated really quickly. And then all of a sudden, you know, of course food and water, stuff like that helped him get a little bit of energy. But I mean, 3,400 feet down in a cave is pretty crazy. And just looking at all the reviews, but the stories and stuff like that. And they had a map of where he was and how crazy it was. But I know two of the guys on the New Jersey search and rescue team that are expert in mountain rescue went down there or went up and over there to help rescue him. So that's, I gotta admit, that's pretty crazy. 200 rescuers, you know,
I had read that they gave each of the crews a segment to focus on so that there wouldn't be people working with people they didn't know, or everybody got a segment. They'd pass off the guy through the different segments. But you think about how many people in the world have that talent. I mean, it can't be that many.
That's true.
It seemed like a pretty unique skill set.
Yeah. And you guys know rope climbing, tying knots, stuff like that. Angle, low angle rescue, high angle rescue requires a lot of skill and requires some heavy thinking because one little wrong knot tie or wrong like angle and that person's in a serious injury. So crazy stuff. But like I said, usually I have a bunch of stories. My friend Dave from our search and rescue team sends me stories of all things happening all the time, and not too much stuff is happening. And luckily stuff in the Catskills has died down. You know, you guys, of course, have sort of been on the down low. I got to admit the Catskills has a little bit more this year than the Adirondacks has, surprisingly, like rescue missions and stuff like that, especially in the Clove. But you guys have been more active than usual.
Yeah. We were just looking at our search and rescue numbers and, you know, me and Russell, we cover the Southern Catskills, so the Catskills in Sullivan County and Ulster County. And we're up, I think we're at 30 search and rescue missions this year, which is, I think we'll double last year's numbers.
Wow.
What I see with the Catskills over the years, we always talk about this, is the shoulder season seem to be the busiest parts for us. You know, we're so close to New York City that, you know, those nice, beautiful summer months, there's just other stuff to do. People out on the beaches. But, you know, those early, nice, warm April, late March weekends, you know, we get a lot of people getting in trouble because they don't realize there's still 2 feet of snow on the ground on the peaks. And, you know, same with the fall. The trail is just such a different animal when you got wet leaves on it. We get a lot of these late season lower leg injuries. It's getting dark a lot sooner than people think. And yeah, shoulder seasons. By that, I mean, you know, before the warm season, right after the warm season, seem to be busy. Especially, you know, I always kind of think Columbus Day weekend is probably the busiest hiking weekend in the Catskills. A lot of our front country problem areas have, you know, already died down, you know, Peak Moose area, the day trippers just going to swimming holes, that kind of ends. But the, you know, the real numbers on the trails, you know, we're going to see those until the leaves are off.
Yeah, definitely. And like I said, you know, the funny thing is I haven't introduced you guys yet, so we'll get to that in a second. But yeah, the numbers have been up. We've seen helicopter rescues and ankle injuries, stuff like that. So once again, thank you guys for your awesome support that you give the hikers and the local residents and everybody out there, because it's been a crazy season for you, crazy year, just reading these ranger reports and seeing the Catskills kind of like more numbers than the Adirondacks, because you usually hear about the Adirondacks all the time and, you know, these people getting themselves in the high peaks and doing stupid things of having one water bottle and no backpack and food. So, but kudos to you guys. You guys have been kicking axe. I gotta be appropriate here. I gotta be appropriate. This is a professional one.
Gotta know our limits. So
I gotta know your limits. You guys are on the clock, right? So you guys can't have some beer or anything, right?
I'm familiar that you normally have a beverage during these things. So to play along, I brought a little bit of water from the Slide Mountain spring. So I'm gonna drink my Slide Mountain water here, and I'll give you some tasting notes after a few sips.
I'm surprised, you know, I know Martin, I know I've been on missions with you before, but I am surprised you know of the show. Like I didn't think you guys knew of the show.
I sit in a truck for 8 hours a day when it rains, and I've listened to my fair share of podcasts.
Sweet. Slade, we knew each other from a long time ago, but did you know of the podcast besides me telling you about it? Have you?
Yeah, we've got I've heard about it. I know you had some of our guys on in the past, and, you know, I think it's a good link up for us. We don't have we've got a great press guy.
Yeah, definitely.
See those highlights. But I think as a group, we could get our message out better and tell our story better. And, you know, I think this is a good thing for us. And I was excited when you asked, and just, you know, me and Russell talking about, you know, what we could get out better. Again, telling our story, and we know our rules and regulations are confusing because, I mean, a good part of our day is on the phone with members of the public answering questions. And
yeah,
if we could give the ranger perspective on some of the larger questions people have, you know, we're happy to do it.
Heck yeah.
Certainly help someone out in the process that's getting the good word of the Catskills out.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, you know, more of the people that listen to this podcast are the veteran hikers, and they don't really interact with the rangers as much. And I guarantee they'd like to hear your stories and what you guys do for throughout the day. And then kind of also, this is a big thank you to you guys, you know, because you guys are just absolutely phenomenal. And we're glad to have you here in the Catskills, as you probably already know. And I hope you're glad to be in the Catskills too. And, you know, guys, don't leave, please don't leave. So awesome. Thank you once again. So welcome to episode 94 of Inside the Line of Catskills. So I have Rangers Slade and Martin here, Kevin Slade and Russell Martin here. I've met these guys before. We've talked about having them on the show. It's been a busy season for them, so it's been a while, but I've met Slade before. He's trained me on certain things in search and rescue. Same thing with Martin. I've been actually on a couple missions with Martin. So welcome to the show, guys.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Jeff's also standing by. So Jeff's sitting there. He can say hi if he wants to real quick.
Hey, everybody.
I had to get him in here. See, it's a little bit more laid back than the last time I had this, when I was like nervous as heck and shivering and stuff like that. So thank you to the monthly supporters, Darren White, Vicky Ferrer, John Comiskey, Jim C., Michael Bongner, David Mead, Matt Smith, and Denise Weiss. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Also, thank you to sponsors, Outdoor Chronicles Photography, also Trail Brown Project. So also thank you to Brenda Robbie for 5 coffees. Really appreciate that. Hope you're having a good time. Good to see you at the 3500 Club meeting. It was great. Congratulations on getting your patch. So get you guys, once again, Martin, you said you were drinking some Slide Mountain tap water. Is that correct?
Yep. We were up just a couple of days ago doing the Traverse, just trying to brush up on some of our signage before the leaf peepers show up. And I took an opportunity to hump a Nalgene of water down, but it's minerally. I'm noticing a piece of moss floating around in it somehow. It's always a pleasure to, I don't know. I mean, there's so many springs and such great water here. I'm joking aside, I do try to make an effort to bring a Nalgene home whenever I'm out.
Well, Slade, you got anything to drink, buddy?
I've got some New Paltz office tap water.
Is that nice? Oh man, is that from the Catskills or is it not?
I have no idea. Not,
I don't know if they tap into the aqueduct. That's a good question.
Yeah, that's a good question. I got to get somebody on here from the aqueduct about that history. It's phenomenal. I am having a Wager's cider, hard cider from up in the Finger Lakes. This previous weekend, I went up to the Finger Lakes and I went to this small apple cider place. Looks like a hole in the wall place, and they had some hard cider and I decided to try it, and it's absolutely fantastic. They don't ship anywhere, unfortunately. They're too small to do so, but this is some of the best hard cider that I've had. And I drink a lot of hard cider. Not saying I'm an alcoholic, but I drink a lot. So previous hikes, Martin, you said you did the Burroughs Range. You want to talk about that real quick?
Daily patrol. I mean, we're all over the Catskills. Certainly in the district that I cover, and Kevin as well, we've got plenty of trail peaks, trail-less peaks, but areas that we maintain signage and campsites and the like. And this was just a daily patrol up and over to, again, put eyes on some of the campsites before the busy leaf peeping season kicks off. I had not been up in maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks at that point. And it's been a busy year. Talking to the 3500 Club stewards at the trailhead, talking to campers and hikers myself at Woodland Valley or at Slide Mountain Trailhead. I'd been doing the math and I'd been assuming that there were definitely more people up in the campsites than there were actual campsites. But the Burroughs Range has fared pretty well. It looked good. No abandoned sites, nothing like that. It looked pretty good.
Yeah, I got to admit, it's, I think the word is getting out, you know, the education is getting out.
I think it is.
Yeah. And that's good. You know, Jeff has been working hard with the public and, you know, as well with me and a bunch of other people, and getting the word out is actually working. Hopefully, maybe we just got to get it, push it down to the Clove area. And get that over to Clove area and help that area out. But other than that, I think people are taking care, like you said, of the campsites, you know, camping where they're supposed to. I mean, I guarantee you have those cowboy campers once in a great while, but hopefully they're smart enough to leave no trace. And, you know, like I said, hopefully the education is getting out. The internet is working finally. Slade, how about you? Have you done anything lately?
Yeah, I guess my last hike, last patrol hike up on Mount Tobias, Woodstock, one of my nice little bit of a low key spot, stretch my legs, clear my head, was doing an acorn beech nut survey. If there's any hunters listening, they'll understand what I'm talking about. That's a trailless peak, real quick hike, tons of different ways to approach it. It's got some real neat geology and some cool cliff lines up there. So quick hitter, but yeah, nice peak. It's convenient that you can drive 80% of the way up, so it's
there, not very ambitious. Yeah, definitely. There you go. I mean, that's fantastic. At least you guys are getting out somewhat, being able to get out instead of just being on rescues and missions all the time like that. just to have your own personal time on the trail is fantastic. And I recently haven't really done anything. I've kind of been working and stuff like that. Like, we were going to try to get something going in the Finger Lakes, do an awesome hike up Conklin's Gully, which is like a 1 mile hike, but it has like 600 feet of gain and like 18 waterfalls. So, but unfortunately we didn't get to it because we went to a distillery and then a hard cider place. And we were just like, oh, we're done. We don't really want to go out in the trails after that. Good idea. Especially
I think the Finger Lakes is one of the least appreciated areas of the state. Just a beautiful area. Great fishing, great wineries, great hikes, just beautiful country.
Yeah. I mean, I've been up there many times. I've hiked part of the Finger Lakes Trail, not all of it, but they have some of the most coolest waterfall hikes that are just off the beaten path that nobody knows about but the locals. And if the locals take you there, you know, they have 110-foot waterfalls that nobody knows about. They have 80, 90-foot waterfalls that you can climb up with a rope with, and it's just absolute fantastic time. Like, I hope anybody, like you said, it's very underappreciated, and I'd probably, because it's an absolute middle of nowhere, getting there is a drive for me. 3.5 hours for me to get up in the Penyan area is where I was, up by Cuca Lake, so the more secluded area away from Ithaca and Watkins Glen and stuff like that. So, but that's about it for me. So once again, Catskill News Volunteer, 3500 Club, Catskills Trail Crew, Catskill Mountain Club's Visitor Center. Volunteer when you can, help the Rangers out, help a lot of the different areas out, and 8 hours a year can make a huge, massive difference in the Catskills, can clean off our trails, make the trails more usable and more desired in the backcountry instead of just the most famous trails like, you know, Hunter and Plateau and stuff like that. Also, if you need some stickers, email me or go to Camp Catskill in Tannersville. All right. Usually I do some history. I was looking up some history on the Forest Ranger stuff, but I couldn't find and I couldn't put together a decent small area of Forest Ranger history. But I do know that the Forest Rangers came adapted from the Fire Tower Observers, correct?
There were fire wardens. We had a phenomenal website. It has recently been taken offline. I believe it's in the process of being resurrected, that delve into our history all the way back to 1885. I don't think either one of us is going to pretend to be a historian on the Rangers, but there is a lot of information out there, and it has been a multi job title progression that has resulted in what we have now with Forest Rangers, state police powers, the like.
Yeah, we take a lot of pride in that history. You know, we're many generations into this career, and it's adapted. And, you know, in my 17 years, the job's changed a little bit too. And you talk to the guys stepping out and retiring now, it's a different job. And
sure,
I'm sure by the time me and Russell hang it up, we'll be saying the same thing. So yeah, it's adapted with the times, but Forest Rangers, you know, whether you want to go back to 1885 when we were fire wardens, or, you know, adopting the job title Rangers, we've been around as long as the preserve in different capacities, and just doing the business that needed to be done to protect the people, protect the resource. And we're proud to be part of that tradition.
Yeah. Proud to have you guys here. Once again, like, sorry, I was going to come up with something, but I just couldn't find something that I could piece together bit by bit to make it a quick intro or a quick rundown of what the Rangers did, because there's, like you said, there's a lot of resources out there for to look up Ranger information. So check it out if you can. So let's do our last bit of sponsors. So Camp Catskill in Tannersville has some hiking stuff, has everything you need. Check them out in Camp Catskill in Tannersville to get some hiking merchandise or gear. Also, Scenic Route Guiding helps you out with guiding any mountains in the Adirondacks or the Catskills. Check out Scenic Route Guiding. Also, Another Summit, a nonprofit program that leads outdoor adventures, activities, and veterans and first responders for free. So check out Another Summit. All right, let's get into the guest of the night.
Let's go.
So tonight I have Rangers Slade and Martin from Region 3, right? Am I correct?
Correct.
All right. So the regions really screw me up sometimes. So I got to get that down. So Rangers Slade and Martin from Region 3, and they're here to talk about their daily life. Got some questions from some fans and stuff like that of the show. And they're just here to talk about the Rangers, hopefully get a little bit more information about the Catskill Rangers and what they do and how awesome they are. So Slade, how about a little bit of background on yourself, sir?
Yeah. Kevin Slade. I started with the Forest Rangers in 2007. I think me and Russell kind of have similar stories in that we were the babies of our academy classes. I was only 6 months out of college. I went to SUNY Cortland, grew up in Buffalo. My initial posting as a Ranger, as we tend to do, is you fill empty slots when you graduate the academy. We do a six-month academy that covers law enforcement. We graduate with a municipal police certificate. You know, you get a master's degree in search and rescue there. You get a master's degree in wildland fire. I started down in Suffolk County, down in the Pine Barrens of Long Island. Was there 6.5 years. And been in the Catskill since 2013. Live with my wife and three kids in Saugerties. And, you know, spent my whole career up here in northern Ulster. I'm a lieutenant now, so I supervise the 8 Rangers that cover the Catskills in Region 3, which is Ulster and Sullivan County.
When did you become a lieutenant?
I took an 8-month stint in our central office as our fire lieutenant, and I've been back in Ulster County maybe 14 months.
Nice. Congratulations.
Back home.
Nice. Congratulations. That's awesome.
Thanks.
Martin, how about you, sir?
So I graduated the Wanakino Ranger School in 2009 and then ESF, the SUNY College of Environmental Science and Forestry, in 2011. I'll take a step back and say that the Ranger School is an associate's degree program that focuses on creating woodsmen, foresters, surveyors, and the like. It has nothing to do with the forest ranger profession nowadays. From there, I worked as a forester for a couple of years for a county up in northern New York, managing timberland, working with private landowners, doing recreation stuff. Enjoyed it a lot, but when I was offered the opportunity to be a ranger, it was a no-brainer. I entered the academy in May of 2013. And after that, it was down to New York City for me. We put one ranger out of most academies down into the city. Back in the late 90s, early 2000s, the 5 boroughs had a lot of land coming up for sale, primarily on Staten Island. The state had deeper pockets than the city at that point. So some of these really cool pieces of land were acquired by the Department of Environmental Conservation. And anybody that spends time in the city, I know Staten Island's a dirty word, but the Greenbelt, Mount Loretto, there's just some absolutely beautiful pieces of land down there that don't get the recognition they deserve. I was down there for 3 years. It was a very unique spot to be a ranger. I mean, you're a brand new officer. You're down there in many ways without a huge support structure. You know, you're the only ranger there. You don't have a lot of colleagues to lean on. You're also working in a city that has one law enforcement agency. So you're kind of figuring things out as you go. I did that for 3 years. I enjoyed the food, the people. You know, a shout out to the Boy Scouts down there and how generous and kind they were. It was a great place to move around and work with parks and work with all these other agencies since you were kind of a solo entity. From there, I transferred up to the Catskills where I've been now for 7 years. I've been up in kind of the Ashokan Reservoir area for that whole duration, 7 years. It's been a nice. Wild ride.
Yeah. I mean, back in 2018, we knew you guys from starting our search and rescue group, and you guys trained us in multiple different things. And we've been working together, you know, somewhat ever since. I mean, you guys haven't needed us much, which is a good thing. Very good thing, I got to admit. but I've known Slade and Martin for a while now, and we kind of keep in touch. I see Slade and Martin once in a while. We've been on several missions together. So it's good to get to know you guys and get to know the heart of the Catskills, to get to know the guys who are, you know, putting their blood, sweat, and tears into keeping our resources together, keeping the people safe and stuff like that. So glad to have you guys on the show, and awesome to have you here once again. So what made you seek the career of a forest ranger? Like, can you answer that question?
I mean, I'll jump in and say that I grew up in very close to that ranger school, that SUNY college that is a pathway that many rangers take. As a kid, I knew the professor's kids and in some instances knew the professors themselves. And it was a very natural transition to go from high school to applying to the Wanakina Ranger School and attending college there. From there, one thing led to another. I had a director at that school that was big on encouraging people to take civil service exams, knowing that as a 19-year-old kid or 20-year-old kid, you might not know what the rest of your life is going to hold. And if you've taken a civil service exam, you're sitting on a list somewhere for maybe years. And it was that simple. As a forester, I started to get a taste of really being outdoors as a profession. And when the phone call came to be a ranger, I jumped at it.
Was it exciting to get that call?
It was. It came at a time where I was starting to wonder if I had made the right choice by moving home so quickly. I grew up in the Adirondacks again, and it was just it was a quiet area. It was a very quiet area.
Nice. Slade, how about you?
I think for me, I want to say that I, you know, when I was 10 years old, I knew exactly what I wanted to do and worked hard to achieve that goal. I certainly knew of forest rangers. I went to SUNY Cortland for a biology degree without really knowing exactly what I wanted to do with it. I saw really quickly that I just excelled at the field aspects of the major, and the classroom lab stuff wasn't really my forte. I ran into a forest ranger handing out applications to take our exam in the dining hall one morning. I remember being pretty hungover. I was an athlete too, probably more into partying, girls, and sports than I was my coursework. And Ranger Rogers, now Major Rogers, was in the dining hall handing out the application. I took the test. I've always been a pretty good test taker. I was in college, so I was used to taking tests, did well enough. And I got the call for the job 6 months out of school. I was back home living with my parents, working at Eastern Mountain Sports, and just wondering why I went to 4 years of college. So it came at a perfect time. My girlfriend from high school, from college, she's now my wife. She's a Long Islander. So the first posting in Long Island worked out really well for me, and I've been blessed. Things have just worked out really well for me, way better than I ever deserved. And yeah, I'm just grateful.
I wouldn't say more than deserved. I mean, Cortland, I know, is a party school, man. I know my sister went there, and they also, what is it called with Oneonta? Don't you guys have like a certain name with the Red Dragons?
Yeah, SUNY Cortland Red Dragons. I think Cortland's probably infamous now for its football game with Ithaca every year, the Cortica Jug. That's when every student in Cortland has their 12 closest friends up for the weekend, and it's a bit of a rager.
Yeah. I remember seeing stuff about that.
I'm willing to admit.
I've seen stuff about that. It's been crazy. My sister went there, and also a couple of my friends went there, and we've had our fair share of fun there. And the sports there, I got to admit, is very very live, alive there, and they take it very seriously in Cortland, which is crazy for being what is a Division III, I'm thinking.
Yeah, it's a Division III school, but you know, kind of more. It's got a pretty robust phys ed program. It's got a very robust sports training program. So it certainly has facilities that are at that D1 level. I was a runner through college. So took full advantage of beautiful track facilities and good trainers, and yeah, it was a good experience.
Nice. So both of you being in your background, you kind of were into the forest area already, so that kind of brought you into the forest ranger life. What part of being a forest ranger didn't the schooling prepare you for?
I've been a ranger 17 years. I wouldn't know what coursework to put together to train you for our job. You know, it's still to this day, I think I have a hard time, and maybe Russell can back me up on this. You know, when people say exactly what is your job, our day-to-day is just so different. It takes just a high degree of thinking on your feet, of solving really pretty complex problems with dire consequences if you make bad decisions on a rescue or a wildfire. So I think a lot of our job is personality. But me and Russell both have, you know, we'll both probably undersell it, but you know, we're both critters. We grew up in the woods. We spend our off time in the woods. You know, the woods is in our blood. And you couple that with just being able to think on your feet, talk with people, interact with people well, be able to articulate yourself well. Just, it fits in well. We're just always by ourselves. You know, out where there's no cell coverage, no radio coverage. It's a really, really unique work environment.
The job varies a fair amount based on whether you're on Long Island or in the High Peaks or in Central New York. But I think one thing that's hard to prepare anyone for is, you know, death and injury. And that's something that's pretty universal across the state. People will always get hurt. People will always lose their lives in some way. And oftentimes rangers are there to assist in some way.
Yeah. You guys have a pretty good way of handling and dealing with the stress from other people and their injuries and stuff like that, way of calming them down. So like anything else that you think of when you went to school and stuff like that, that when you came onto as a ranger, you were just like, oh crap, I wasn't prepared for this. Any like, do you think to being a ranger would be the interactions with people, it's got to be like over the top. You didn't think like, oh, I'm a ranger, I'm in the middle of nowhere, I'm going to be in the middle of nowhere all the time. But all of a sudden, boom, the internet happens and COVID happens. You guys are flushed with people.
I think it requires a ton of patience that I don't know that people get. I mean, we get phone calls. I mean, I couldn't begin to tell you some of the questions we get over the phone. And just the degree of patience it takes to treat everybody with respect. Everybody has their own normal. I was telling Jeff before the call here, it's like you could drop me in the middle of Manhattan and I'm going to be totally out of my element. I try to treat people with that same respect when they call me and ask where the entrance to the Catskill Park is or where they park, you know, to go to the Catskill Park. And, you know, they're so off base with what they're even asking me that it's hard to answer the question. And, you know, just treat everybody like they're a close friend. You know, you try to feed them information. You try to help them out as best they can. Yeah. I mean, sometimes the level of ignorance on the calls you'll get or questions you get from people are, it can be astounding if you take it personally, but they're just people that need a little bit of help and a little bit of guidance. And certainly been called back plenty of times, you know, 3-4 days later. And it's like, hey, that was the greatest campsite. Thanks so much. I never would have found that without you. Or, you know, thanks for that tip. We really appreciate that. And, that's the kind of stuff that keeps you going.
Cool. Nice. Yeah. It's gotta be crazy now, with the influx of people since COVID. I couldn't even imagine. So like, besides, have you both been to the Catskills before you were a forest ranger, or was it like kind of new to you?
When I was down in the city, I had no idea where I wished to go. I knew that opportunities to transfer would come up. And I was trying pretty hard to decide what areas I would want to land in. When the transfers come out, you don't have a lot of time to make a decision. You better have some background knowledge. So a friend of mine from the Finger Lakes and I put the effort into doing the 35 peaks. This was back when Double Top and Graham were still climbable, as a way for me to try to decide if the Catskills were somewhere that I wished to land. And it ended well.
Nice.
I was one of those ignorant guys at the Catskills. I'll admit it. Like I said, I grew up just outside the city of Buffalo, right in the suburbs. I just spent a ton of time in the Adirondacks throughout my life. That's where I always saw myself ending up when I was able to transfer off Long Island. I did mention I have a Long Island wife, so the Catskills were quite a bit more appealing to her, being a little closer to home. I knew some of the guys that worked up in the Catskills. They had great things to say about it, and again, I tell you, I'm just grateful for the way things played out. You know, I landed in a great spot up in Ulster County. And again, like just happenstance luck, fell in love with it. You know, 10 years later, it's been a great spot to work, great spot to grow, great spot to work and raise a family.
Yeah, I got to admit, it has a little bit of everything. I mean, we don't have the open summits as the Adirondacks does, or the whites and stuff like that, but we have the viewpoints that'll blow your mind away. We have the off trail areas that you can find something that you didn't think was there, a bunch of other stuff like that. So that's awesome. Glad you guys kind of landed here instead of the Adirondacks like everybody else does and stuff. So your daily life as a forest ranger, I remember you saying basically driving around and taking calls. Is that what it consists of?
It's so varied per ranger. And again, based on where you are, a lot of it is also seasonal too, right? You know, maybe you're in fire season and you're worried about a Western fire or a fire here in the Hudson Valley. Maybe you know that it's going to be a big weekend for camping or the hunting season's kicking off. It would be a 2-hour podcast just to talk about what a given year looks like for the average preserve ranger. It's so varied. There's so much ability to, I'll say, specialize or humor yourself. And we're not given a set schedule. We're choosing what we do and where we think we're going to be useful that day. And it just means that, again, every day truly is different.
Yeah, I think you wake up with a plan and an idea of what you want to do. And it's kind of one of the beautiful parts of the job is you always end up kind of somewhere else doing something different.
Yeah,
I think we all, it's the guys that we work with. I mean, we'd love to just do 1,000 miles on the trails every year, but come summertime, 90% of our users are right roadside, you know, roadside camping spots, you know, the easy to access spots like Ontario Lake or Pico Moose. And those are the areas we need to be, not necessarily where we want to be. I'd love to climb slide every single day of the year, but duty kind of drags you other places. And our emergency response, you know, is always in the back of our heads. Just for, you know, random Tuesday, 2 days ago, you know, I had plans. I was going to go walk a ridge in Woodstock. I haven't been on in a while. And 10 o'clock in the morning, we're over in the town of Esopus looking for a missing guy in his ATV. 3 o'clock, we get a call for a broken ankle on Pico Moose Mountain. You know, random Tuesday, you know, guys, you know, people have plans after work, got to take their kids to ball practice. And, you know, the guys in the county are working 16-hour day to, you know, take a couple emergency calls that, you know, we didn't see coming. So just being prepared for that. We get dragged around a lot. We're very reactive when things happen. It's just the way we have to be. We'd love to be proactive all the time, but time doesn't always allow for that.
Yeah. Your daily activity is like you said, all over the place. Whether it's, you know, you're just out patrolling or something like that. And all of a sudden, the fire call is actually like one of the thing that baffles me is crazy is how, even though we've got rain, how, you know, next year, you don't know if there's going to be a crazy wildfire season or stuff like that. And I've seen you guys have, the New York State has sent a lot of people over out west to help for wildfires, which is awesome. A lot of people do not know your guys' ability and your talent that you have. You're not just, you know, telling someone, hey, this is a bad campsite, you know, you can't camp here. You're doing all of the above, which is insane to me most of the time. And you guys know the forest and stuff like that. So it's really crazy. Once again, to how much knowledge you guys have and how much knowledge or how much the people don't know about the knowledge you guys have.
12 months out of the year, we are training, ropes, whitewater, fire locally, fire out west, the incident command system, firearms. That's every month we are training.
Incident command. We could talk about that all the time, man. That's got to be some insane stuff.
Yeah, there's certainly some stories to tell for sure. Yeah, it's the broad spectrum. Like, you know, if you had to break it down to like a set skill, it's like, I think a lot of us live for the emergency response stuff. If you take the forest ranger job to be a cop, like you're probably going to be pretty bored. Like, you know, a lot of our, you know, quote unquote enforcement is just education.
People
stumble into violations on state land all the time. You know, we don't deal with a lot of malicious violations in the Catskills. You know what? You hike enough, you're going to see someone camped where they shouldn't be in the Catskills. Those are usually people that just need a little bit of guidance and education, get them in the right spot, protect the resource. I think the emergency response stuff is certainly been the part of my career that I've enjoyed the most. You know, we just go on these crazy calls with, you know, you go out with 5 or 6 of your buddies at 6 o'clock at night and don't come home for 12 hours. And just, we definitely got some stories, and that's the stuff that keeps us close as a group and makes you appreciate the guys you work with.
And maybe later on we'll have an episode strictly on Force Ranger stories if Jeff will allow it. Hopefully. Yeah, I gotta hear some of it. Like I said, like Incident Command. A lot of people don't know about Incident Command, and it is a tough job. You know, I've done training on that. I've done, you know, missions on that. And I got to admit, to do Incident Command with 10, let alone 50 volunteers or 50 people is absolutely insane. Just the progress, the process and stuff like that. And people being impatient of how to get out and when to get out and stuff like that is insane. So you guys got a lot on your shoulders with the search and rescue aspect and stuff like that. So once again, thank you for that, all that stuff, because a lot of people don't know about that. And that's why you guys are trained in every so aspect of this force, because you do not know what you're going to get that day. So incredible. So one thing I have to talk about that's not on this list, as I forgot to add it, the so-called chair incident up on Slide Mountain. Now, Martin, I know you were involved with that. Slade, were you involved with that?
No, I wasn't. Well, let Russell talk about that one.
Okay, so Russell, what exactly happened? My friend was involved in that, but I ran a background about it. I did a little thing, but how was that to deal with?
I listened to that podcast, and I'm so bad with names here. Forgive me. The gentleman that had been doing the trail work presented a very accurate depiction. I'll fill in a couple of holes. It was a uncle and I guess a brother, sister, and then the sister's two children. The male child, approximately 18, had constructed these chairs in a shop class. After traveling out west and seeing chairs on viewpoints, apparently in, I believe, British Columbia was brought up, they wanted to do something nice. They wanted to bring these chairs up and place them on a viewpoint here in New York. You know, and I don't believe there was anything malicious about it. I've spoken to the gentleman since. I do appreciate that they tried to do something that they thought was in some ways a public service. Obviously, we know that being able to put things on viewpoints, being able to leave your mark in a wilderness area is not appropriate. But the idea was still born out of something more or less good. So those chairs were removed. I'm, again, being terrible with names. I have forgotten who the summit steward is. But the summit steward that day on Slide had hiked up Slide, back down Slide, just as this was all transpiring. And that gentleman was kind enough to hike up Slide a second time that day and carry one of those chairs down with me while I carried the other. We will see those chairs to something that benefits the public. I think right now when the court case is through that they'll probably go to the campground. I'd like to see them to like Woodland Valley Campground, something like that where they can be enjoyed. But yeah, I don't know. I had read, and the internet is a horrible place. I'd read lots of stuff about how this guy said this or that or tore a ticket up. I mean, none of that happens. He was a little frustrated to have done all that work and be told no. But at the end of the day, again, this was supposed to be a kind gesture, not a middle finger to the Catskills.
Yeah.
And like, I think that story is just a good proxy to something we run into all the time, which is like, you know, as Rangers, you know, we're not land managers. We're just here as the representative of the people to keep things the way they should be. And wilderness means different things to different people, but there is, you know, a definition of law, what is okay and what isn't. And, you know, you see it on our backcountry campsites, you know, everyone wants to make their little improvement for the benefit of everybody else. And then eventually it doesn't look like wilderness anymore. And it's like death by a thousand cuts, tragedy of the commons, whatever you want to call it. You know, our job is to kind of hold that line and, you know, be out there enough to keep things the way they should be. And the benefit of the Catskills is there's just such a good core community of hikers that do so much of this work behind the scenes. And title or no title, summit steward or just avid hiker that's willing to tell someone they can't camp on Wittenberg. And, you know, that just doing the good work behind the scenes, it's something I've come to really appreciate about the Catskills as a ranger.
Yeah. And, you know, once again, the internet it's a crazy place, said this and that and the other thing. And the thing that I was talking about at the time of that podcast was that if one person does it, how many other people will do it?
Oh, I'll be the second person. The second it's allowed, I'm running up there with a chair. I said this before with my grandfather's name on it. That'll be the next chair up there. You know, we can't all do it.
Yeah. And there'll be a picnic table up there, and then there'll be three or four picnic tables, and then people will leave their chairs up there. It's a whole, the leave no trace there structure is there for a reason, because I do not want to go up there and have a garbage can up there where I've hiked 3-4 miles in to get a viewpoint and to make it feel like, you know, I could have done this in my backyard. So once again, and I heard how was carrying those chairs down that mountain. I mean, slide isn't the most easy, difficult, but those chairs, were they straight up like hardwood and stuff like that, or were they like,
they were constructed out of number 2 pine, just a 1x4 pine. I weighed the chair, it was 24 pounds. It's hard to explain, but we ended up both of us wearing the chairs by having the armrests on our chest and what would be the seat of the chair on our backs with our backpacks on. And I'll speak for myself. I don't think the summit steward was enjoying it quite as much, but it was an absolute perfect fit. They just slid right on. They sat there on the chest pads, and we didn't take a break. We just motored out of there.
Wow. It was
a funny sight. There's no photos, thank God, but it was a funny sight.
And they had those like hexagon screws and stuff like that.
They used square drive screws, which you still see in deck construction and stuff like that. For anybody that I think saw the comments in the Times Union article, I had hiked up there with a Phillips head and a flathead screwdriver. I was very proud of myself for having tools in the truck. I thought this would be a simple matter to disassemble and carry down. And I was frustrated to get up there and see these square drive like deck screws had been utilized for this project. I'm sure there's a square drive screwdriver out there somewhere, but I don't own one.
Somewhere. That's definitely
not a common item in our packs.
Not at all, man. That's not the something you carry with you 24/7 and stuff like that in the back of your car or something.
This was a shop class. I mean, somewhere in that shop class, there was a box of screws that had been left over from some other project.
Yeah. Well, cool. That's awesome. Thank you once again for doing that, because that's just a crazy incident once again. To hike up there to slide the top of Slide Mountain and to hear about somebody who's installing chairs as a stop top there is just something I've never heard of before. I don't.
It's funny from our end watching what grabs the public's attention. Yeah, like
for sure.
For every incident like that, there's 5 or 6 others that just, you know, we go grab some. We've been, especially the last couple of years, seem to be clearing up a ton of campsites that people just walk away from for some unknown reason. It's like, you know, they were abducted by aliens in the middle of the night, and their sleeping bag and their tent and their cooking gear and their garbage just sits there, you know, in the forest for a month until we drag it out of the woods. It just seems to be a recent trend. But I'm talking tonnage over the Catskill Park that we've dragged out of the woods over the last few years.
Yeah. Wouldn't that be nice to get the other side of the stories of, you know, like, oh, sure. I mean, that's a pretty cool story, but, you know, more of the rescue side and the hard work that you guys do besides something that is just kind of like trending and stuff. You know, there have been rescues, but there have been silent rescues in the Catskills where someone has hurt their ankle on the side of a mountain you guys rescued. And I've only heard of it through, you know, the DEC website or for word of mouth from somebody else. So wouldn't that be nice? You know, wouldn't that be nice if the internet was all positive? Yeah, right. So one of my biggest questions is, you know, I've been trained together with you guys and stuff like that. What is in your pack daily? That I guarantee is a question that everybody has, because you got to be prepared for anything and everything.
I think I'm going to disappoint your viewer audience here when I tell them what I usually carry in my pack. You know, in my years,
don't get yourself in trouble, Slade. Don't get yourself in trouble.
I'm a minimalist. I hate carrying extra stuff. I mean, if I'm going on a daily patrol, you know, even doing that full Burroughs Range pack or track, like I drink a lot of stream water. I know where the springs are. I mean, I've left my truck with nothing really in my pack other than a tarp, a lunch, and a couple empty water bottles. You put enough miles on the trail and you carry something you never use. I'm not a big creature comfort guy. I've slept plenty of nights in the woods, just sleeping under a tarp in my clothes. I know what I need to be comfortable, and it's not much. I can do a lot with a lighter and lunch and a couple water bottles.
Crazy.
And a lot of that's the rescue aspect of our job is, I don't have the ability to keep a pack packed, because whatever the mission is, I'm going to have to throw other stuff in there. You know, this carryout we did two nights ago on Peekamoose Mountain, I was like the 19th guy in the woods. So I don't need a first aid kit because there's one ahead of me. You know, I don't need a tarp because there's one ahead of me in the woods. So I'm looking at what unique gear I'm going to carry in. I ended up carrying in all the gear to do, the rope work on that particular carryout. And I carried in half the litter. So if I've got all this extra redundant stuff that my crew has or the guys ahead of me have, you know, I'm just wearing myself out for no reason. So it's really, you know, I try to keep my pack empty in my truck, and it's a very conscious thing for me, depending on what I'm doing, what I'm going to load into that. If we're doing sign work, I'm going to very specifically load my hammer, nails, and the trail signs I need for the day. If we're doing trail clearing, I'm going to very consciously add, you know, bar oil, saw gas, check my chainsaw. But that pack usually sits just empty in the truck.
Crazy. Interesting. Martin, how about you, sir?
Yeah, I'll second that. A lot of great ranger days have involved a water bottle or a half empty water bottle, some form of navigation. And I'll secretly admit that I do enjoy topo maps on a cell phone. I think as far as listeners go, and I was hoping to get a chance to say this, the number one reason that I get rolled out of bed is because when the sun goes down, you're kind of stuck. So I always, always, always have two headlamps and fresh batteries. Yeah. Even if it's 10 o'clock and I'm going for an hour long hike, I always have batteries, because one thing leads to another. And now you've worked 16 hours and it's dark. But I think that's a pretty accurate portrayal of what goes into a backpack. I've tried setting backpacks up for different things, and you don't have enough equipment to have a predetermined preset, even the fire pack, always ready to go to just slip out of the truck. Too much is distributed throughout the vehicle, depending on what you're doing that day.
Yeah, I kind of break it down seasonally. You know, obviously winter, you're going to have some more stuff in there, but I'm really looking at what I need to make myself safe if something happens to me. You know, so wintertime, I'm going to add those. I got a nice pair of down pants I'll throw in my pack, my down jacket. Again, real light, compactable. That's going to go in there. A bivy, you know, I got a 50-degree sleeping bag that if I'm wearing my coat and pants, I'm not going to be comfortable all night, but I'm not going to be dead in the morning.
Yeah.
And it's not a horrible amount of weight. I guess, you know, for us, it's like, I'm going in the woods for a little bit different reason. Like we're not just hiking the trails because we want to catch some great views. It's like, we're usually up there to do some sort of work, whether it's, you know, drag out an abandoned site or sign some trails or, you know, we do a lot of early morning, late night hikes, you know, to address camp, you know, legal camping in the wilderness, that, you know, we need to be able to move quick and be reactive to what we run into. But it's kind of there's a little bit of a mission behind why we're hiking on a particular day.
Yeah. Simple things, you know, that I carry also, that a lot of people can carry to help out them and others, possibly, you know, splints, extra socks, extra t-shirt, extra long sleeve t-shirt. You know, like you said, it all depends on the season. You know, the season cold, you might want to pack a little bit more to, you know, help somebody else out or something like that. I always have a splint with me for some reason. I don't know why. Every time, splint and extra gauze pads, just for the hell of it, I guess. I guess I like packing heavy as heck. You know, my pack is, I'm no lightweight backpacker.
Well, we're gluttons when it comes to a rescue. We fight over who gets to carry the litter in and who has to carry the 20 pounds of rope on their back. It's like, who can put the most weight on their back? It's a game. To be honest with you, I think the better question is, like, what do we carry in our trucks? And I mean, the real short answer to a long question of that is, like, the goal for us, and, you know, as a field ranger, it was always my goal, and Russell's the same way, is like, I want to be able to get a call in the middle of the night. And I don't care what the call is. and I put my uniform on and I start driving. I don't think about what I need to get ready because everything I'm going to possibly need for that rescue is in my work truck and ready to go. Yeah. And everything works. I know where it is. I can find it. And then, yeah, get to that scene, adjust, stuff my pack and get to work. And again, it's always going to bounce off with who I show up with. If me and Russell show up at the same time, we're not going to have the same things in our pack because we're going to load up to complement what the other guy's carrying.
Yeah. Just like you guys, you know, being search and rescue, I have everything else in my car just in case I need to run back down, get something else out for the rescue or something like that, you know, that somebody else needs. And like you guys said, everybody carries a different piece to the puzzle to solve the puzzle when you get up top and stuff like that. So it's wicked. Awesome. Always a question I've always wondered, because you guys always look like you're carrying a crap load of stuff, but apparently not. So
I got to say, with the group we work with is like, we deal with a lot of guys that are just really freak athletes. I don't think Russell's ever run like a mile for exercise in his life, but I guarantee you could break 20 minutes in a 5K in his work uniform. Like, we just got quite a few guys who are just really good athletes that can, you know, Tuesday night, Russell and, you know, his partner in that district did the whole Burroughs Range trail and then went to the rescue on Peekamoose, you know, without even having a chance to grab the other truck. And they're guys that can do that and then be at work at 8 a.m. without a sore muscle. So I think we get away with a little bit because we are, you know, we're athletic guys and gals, and we spend our time in the mountains and probably a little bit better at getting ourselves out of trouble than maybe other people.
Awesome. And we're probably crazy.
Some luck, I'm sure, genetics or something.
So what percentage of the job is hiking versus like other responsibilities? Can you give a narrow, or I know it's tough, but you know, yes.
I just go back to like the seasonality of our job is big. Like July and August, like I would love to be in the woods every day and checking those backcountry campsites and peak usage, but we're getting pulled off of those responsibilities into the front country heavy use areas that, you know, are a summer problem. And then, you know, come fall, we're back on the trails. We spend a ton of time in the trails, fall, winter, spring, summertime, not so much, but you know, it's certainly our default. If there isn't something else that pops up, something else that needs to get taken care of, you know, we're checking out a drainage we haven't been in. We do a lot of hiking off trail, probably nice. More than the average person. Just, you know, we patrol our boundaries. You know, we're always looking for easier access into things. So we're kind of hiking with a little bit of different goals, I think, than a recreational hiker. But, you know, we're responsible for knowing the trails. I need to be able to get on a phone with somebody that, you know, has a broken ankle on Wittenberg and they're describing what rock they're sitting on, and I got a pretty good idea exactly where they're at. So
crazy.
Yeah.
Awesome. But Martin, how about you? How about percentage wise, do you think you're out on the trails?
I'll echo the seasonality of it, but I did take a look at the last year's worth of, I'll call them reports. We do something resembling a weekly report about where we go, what we do, how much we hike. And on average, I'd say it's roughly 2 days a week that I get out for a good full day hike. You figure there's a good 1 day a week of training on average, whether we're giving or receiving. And then as you advance in your career and take on additional responsibilities, you know, I'm on a committee trying to guide some of our search program. I do the drone, the UAS flights. That takes up time. I sit in offices and do PR stuff once in a while. You do see that the time in the field starts to kind of evaporate. We had an academy graduate within the last year, and to see some of those guys and girls out absolutely hard charging peaks every day, hiking this, getting to know their district, getting to know their surrounding areas. There are young guys and girls out there that are probably hiking, you know, 4 days a week, 5 days a week, and then doing incidents the rest. It depends on where you work, and it depends on who you are too. But I like to think that I get out a fair amount.
Nice. It's always good to hear. Definitely always good to hear. So between the last couple of years, we all know COVID was crazy. And then after COVID, all of a sudden, the rise in hiking freaking exploded. You know, I always compare this to something like the Borscht Belt era of where it was just like, you know, all of a sudden everybody starts coming up to the Catskills and the Adirondacks. What has been some of the struggles you guys have dealt with that amazing rise in hiking after COVID and with the internet surge?
Yeah, the COVID, the COVID era really wore us out. It was like a two-prong attack. You know, you mentioned our incident management capabilities, you know, and that's our kind of historic work on large scale wildfires, large scale searches, where we're good at organizing big groups of people into, you know, successfully carrying out a mission. We were tapped by the governor's office to run quite a few and set up the COVID sites across the state. We were at a point of pretty low staffing anyway, waiting for this last academy to graduate. So there were times when zones that you had seven rangers, you know, covering a county, you might only have two or three of those guys home because, you know, the balance of that is, you know, we're running a COVID site at SUNY Albany or running a COVID site down at Jones Beach. So it really stressed our manpower. And then the guys that were back home doing the day to day were just getting crushed by just this massive influx of use. And, you know, it wasn't the normal use. It was people out getting way in over their head on things they really didn't have any business doing with their experience level. And it was a busy couple of years.
Yeah. Do you guys, Martin, how about you? Just the same kind of experience, or were you more of the one that was out on the field?
The first year of COVID, I did over 800 hours of overtime, and I lived in hotels for months. We would take 2-week assignments, 16-hour days, and you would go. I mean, I went all over. I went from the Hamptons to all over Long Island and Westchester, Rockland, doing these sites. Every site was different, but whether it was a testing site or a vaccination site, the similarity was that you were not in your district. I can remember driving home from 2 weeks on a site and immediately driving to a search or a rescue to help out because we were very understaffed, spread thin at that point. Every ranger that's worked more than a week has hysterical stories of talking to somebody at a trailhead who's about to bite something off that they most certainly cannot accomplish. You know, we, that clientele was up in spades. It was the camping, the if you were after enforcement, the enforcement actions were just far beyond anything else. It's dropped off. I mean, life is pretty well back to normal, but we were spread very, very thin.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't work in the Adirondacks, but man, I have a hard time thinking anybody saw a bigger bump in increase than the Catskills, just with our proximity to New York City. I think it's just a lot of people that discovered the area for the first time. Yeah, there were tough interactions during those years, especially early on. It's like we were tired out, we were worn out, and we're just dealing with people that, like, it might be their only day out of the house in months, you know, and they're trying to do something that, you know, it's like you can't do that here, you know. It's it was like a deal with a lot of desperate people. Yeah, just a weird time for us. It's good to see things kind of leveling out and getting back to what I hope they're kind of stick at, you know, a nice even keel of work.
Yeah. And a lot of, like, once again, the education was there for people, but they didn't research. Like, you know, you have somebody who's like, oh, I don't want to go up to the Giant Ledge Trailhead to take on Panther Mountain. Let me go from Fox Hollow. That's, you know, 3-4 miles longer. And then all of a sudden they're just like, well, I was supposed to be on Giant Ledge and they didn't realize that they're on Giant Ledge and now they're lost, or, you know, they went way over their heads, something like the Burroughs Range, or they go to Slide and then they keep going down and they get over to Cornell and they're like, well, where do I go from here? Well, you got to go back to your car. But of course, like that was crazy influx of hikers. And it was just, you know, just sitting down and watching this, guys, you know, I talked with a bunch of forest rangers, and a lot of people don't know that you guys were on the front lines. You guys were down there with the doctors and the nurses and stuff like that, doing the same exact work. And a lot of people didn't know that. I didn't even know that. So once again, thank you to you guys for at that time stepping up and rising to the challenge and stuff like that. It's really crazy. So this is the best part of the interview that I think, crazy stories that you guys have. Give me one crazy story that you guys have that you want to share with the group that will not get you in trouble. If you could only see the eyes of Slade right there.
Yeah, you got to give us, I mean, it's hard to boil what 17 or 10 years down.
Into yeah, right.
Story. Do you have a direction, a topic, an area, a region?
None at all. Maybe just like a crazy rescue that you had that will not like ever leave your mind. Slade, I've heard some from you, actually from both of you. Actually, I'm pretty sure you had one on Wittenberg Mountain or between Cornell and Wittenberg during the winter or something.
Yeah, I could certainly dive into one or two. Yeah, I'll just say this in general. If I sound, I don't want to sound like a cynic. If you call me from a ridge and you need help, we'll help you. And you don't get far in this career if you've got that negative attitude about it. I will drive past the slide trailhead on my way home and I'll look away because I know I don't want to go hike that mountain. But if I get home and I got a nice dinner on the table and there's a stub toe on the top of the peak, I'll drive right back and climb the mountain. Now we'll come and help you if you need help. We don't give helicopter rides off the mountain just because you want one, but we'll come and help you out. It's our mission. It's what we take this state tax dollars to provide the public. And we're super proud of the service we provide the public. People just have, it's just a numbers game, right? You know, you put 10,000 people on a trail, some weird's going to happen to one of them. And we're happy and we're proud that we can help those people out. Yeah. Take a lot of pride in that. I'll talk about a rescue. It was about the last rescue I did before I became a lieutenant. And it's one that kind of sticks out to me because I made mistakes, which you always do on everything. I think what experience provides you is the ability to think your way out of the position you put yourself in by making those mistakes. So we had, this is another trend I don't think people realize, but I've seen is through my career as a ranger is, we don't get a lot of rescue calls on the busy summer, beautiful August day where there's 200 people doing the Burroughs Range Trail. Because I guarantee you two or three people have sprained an ankle on that day, but they're going to get helped off the mountain by other people and we're never going to hear about it. The more intense calls that we get are that rainy day. This was a September rescue. It was a day where, you know, if you were picking your day to hike that week, you would have ignored, you know, it was a snotty little bit of rain, nobody else on the trail. And this guy who was just really getting into hiking, he'd really gotten after it that year, just getting into hiking, coming down Cornell Crack, took a slip, fell like the last 10 feet, fell tumble. If you know the area, you know, it's vertical, but it's not really. And he broke his ankle. It's a good spot to get injured because you've got cell coverage. We generally like rely on cell coverage above, you know, 3,500 feet, but you know, there's no cell coverage on Cornell. There's no cell coverage between Cornell and Slide. You really got cell coverage on top of Slide and you start to pick it up at Cornell Crack and then you pick it up again at the summit of Wittenberg. So he happened to fall, break his ankle in a spot where he had cell coverage. I weigh 215 pounds. I mean, I'm 215 if I'm dehydrated and hungry. This guy was quite a bit bigger than me. Just to chat with him on the phone. You know, I've had these conversations with people through the years and it's kind of fun. You know, it's hey, you know, I'm Kevin Slade. I'm with the Forest Rangers. I hear you're in a predicament. You calm him down. You tell him you I'm not leaving you. We're going to come and get you. Like it's going to take a while, but you know, we're here to help you out. Always try to give them sort of that time frame. Like, listen, it's noon right now. You will not see me before 2 o'clock. Like it's not happening. There's a ton of moving parts behind the scene to fire up a rescue. I just don't like to give people false expectations. Like, hey, you know, this is going to take a while. So knowing Cornell Crack, I mean, there's not an easy way to get out of there with somebody that can't walk. That's probably pushing 250, maybe more than that. There's just no easy way to do that. We mentioned we do a lot of training. I'm one of our hoist operators locally. What that entails, we work with the state police. We train with them, you know, monthly. We try at least every couple months. What we do is we We fly with the state police helicopters out of Newburgh. And what the hoist is essentially is a winch. Comes out of the helicopter. It's got a hook on it. We'll hook onto a harness and we can lower rescuers down into a scene, or we can pick an injured party up off of a mountain. Locally in the Catskills, I mean, we're good for one or two of those a year. Much more heavily used in the high peaks of the Adirondacks. But, you know, it's interagency. It requires a lot of training, a lot of expertise, and, you know, a lot of trust between ourselves and the pilots. A big part of that is just the behind-the-scenes relationships you got to build. I knew with this spot, like, the most feasible thing for us to do was going to be to hoist him out. Not highly injured, right? He's got a broken ankle. If you did this in your yard mowing your lawn, it's like a non-issue, right? You grab the neighbor, you grab your friend, you grab your wife, you get a ride to the hospital, you get taken care of. In the wilderness context, that's a huge issue because now we're going to dispatch 5 or 10 hour guys. We're going to grab local fire departments. We might tap into local search and rescue teams. You know, it's going to be a massive operation, 25, 30 people. And anyone who's done a carry out, it's not fast. You know, that's got to be 4 or 5 miles in from the nearest trailhead, very ledgy coming down Wittenberg, just a ton of risk to the rescuers. So Rangers working through our process, it's like you got to pick like what's the least dangerous way to do this. There's a lot of risk flying a helicopter on a 3,500 foot peak and lowering rescuers in. There's a lot of risk, a lot of risk to the pilots, a lot of risk to, me, the crew chief and back running the hoist. There's a lot of risk to, just everybody involved. I don't get how helicopters work. Like, they seem like magic to me. So I made the call as the Ranger receiving the call that was our best route. Like, I felt the risk to the rescuers, and the helicopter was justified because of the amount of risk we were going to put ground crews in, you know, to get this guy out. Yes, yeah, so called up. We got the helicopter fired up. They landed right in Phoenicia. There's an LZ at the baseball diamond in Phoenicia. They landed. There was a state police sort. That's their SWAT team guys, highly trained, awesome guys. They also run the hoist. I said, hey, you know, I think this is pretty clear cut. I know the area really well. Why don't you guys lower me right down on the top of Cornell Crack? I'll walk down to this guy. I'll throw a harness on him. We'll pick him back up. We'll get him out of here. And we'll have this guy back down in the village of Phoenicia in a half hour. Like, no brainer. It's super easy. Again, like, for me, this one was making a lot of mistakes and then being able to work ourselves out of it. So we take off out of the Paris field. I'm in the back of the helicopter with a harness on. The state police sword member is going to lower me in right on Cornell Crack. We get up above Woodland Valley, flying in that bowl, and I'm looking at the cloud cover, and it's just eating the tops of each peak. It's like right where we're not going to be able to go on the top of Cornell. We're not going to be able to drop on the top of Wittenberg. And it's not looking great. We see this cloud cover kind of cresting over the ridges, and we're obviously not flying this state police Huey into the cloud cover and lowering someone down. Like, it's just not going to happen. As we're getting up, and these are guys I know the pilots well. They're friends of mine, and we're talking through it on the ship's communication system. And in my head I'm thinking about the physical toll it's going to take on the guys that are going to have to come up behind me to carry this guy out. And I'm like, man, we got to make this work. And again, like, I just feel like a lucky guy all the time. As we were getting up to that, you know, that really knife ridge between Cornell Crack and Wittenberg, we had a brief second where the cloud cover dissipated. As we approached the trail, I mean, I know right where that trail is. I mean, I could draw that map of that whole ridge, you know, from memory. I've been up there so many times. I get on the hook, I get lowered down. I swear to God, I got lowered down as we were still moving forward, dropped on the trail. I've got the harness. I'm good to go. Ship flies back to Phoenicia. Sure enough, as the ship was flying away, the cloud cover just settles right back down on me. So I'm sitting here by myself. I got to run up to Cornell Crack. It's a good quarter mile run. I just jog up, meet the injured guy, start talking through it. And this beautiful plan in my head of putting a harness on him and getting hoisted out is kind of gone. There's a big cloud sitting over me all of a sudden. And I'm looking at this man that's bigger than I am. Awesome guy. Had a great time with him. We're talking through what to do. I didn't fly up with a litter. I had a pretty good rescue pack. I had enough stuff to keep me comfortable and provide him with some water. I grab my phone. I'm going to make a call down, kind of tell him our plan kind of went foobar, and we got to come up with a plan B. I look at my phone and I'm at half battery. I know I just charged the thing. And as I'm watching my phone, it goes from half battery, and all of a sudden my iPhone's blinking, the red light's blinking, and my battery's dying. So I had this guy take a picture of my contact, the ranger I had down at the field, as I watched my phone die. I think I got water in it from the amount of cloud cover, but you know, I kind of went up there thinking my phone was going to work, and all of a sudden that went down. Phoenicia is a pretty radio dead zone. Like, it's just geographically in a bowl that it's really hard to talk out on a radio. Had my portable radio fired up. It works perfect up there on a clear day. I can talk to our dispatchers up in Albany. Click the radio, nothing happens. It's like, oh, you got to be kidding me. Click it again, nothing happens. So now I've got this guy with a broken leg, and I got to borrow his phone, you know, to call the rescuers down and make a plan B for his own rescue. So it was a little embarrassing. Called down, you know, we just reassessed. I said, hey, this cloud cover is bad. I got to get him downhill. I got to get him down below this cloud cover. Here's what I think we should do. State police flies back up. They drop two more rangers in, drop our litter wheel. We load this guy up again. He's a big man. And the three of us, I mean, it took every bit of strength I had. We wheeled him down pretty much the absolute lowest point between Cornell and Wittenberg. It's kind of a secondary ledge. It's below Cornell Crack on the Wittenberg side. It's good, probably 20-foot drop off itself. You don't notice it when you're flying, but you don't notice it when you're hiking, but you notice it when you've got a 250-pound man you got to carry with muscle power down. That was the end of the road for us. We were going to hoist him out of that spot, or we were going to sit, the three of us were going to sit up there with him for another two, three hours waiting for a rescue party to wheel this guy out. Got on the phone again with the pilots, talked them through what we were facing. I was still under cloud cover. We talked it out. We were half hour of daylight left. There wasn't much time to pull this off. They said, hey, we'll give it a try. You know, maybe it'll clear up just at the right time. And we were getting little wind pushes. If you've been up there on a cloudy day, what happens on that ridge is you get kind of a dome of fog that blows over the top. So it looks clear in a little tunnel along the trail, but what you've got is the wind blowing out of the valley goes crest of the ridge, kind of turns to fog, and then it turns back into clear air once it drops down in elevation. So you end up with just a cap of fog over that ridge. They took off again. We could hear them hovering, but they couldn't find us in the fog. We tied a big ribbon of orange. I'm tied it to like a 20-foot stick I found, and I'm just waving in the air. About the last second they saw it and got over us. We hooked him up and got him up into this helicopter right as the fog closed back in. So we were able to get him off the mountain. After he's out, you know, the plan was to hoist us out too. You know, it's a 4-mile walk out. We've got quite a bit of gear at this point. We got a litter. We've got probably 60 pounds of gear that got flown in with the second group, and we got three guys to carry it out. Well, we got our own 45, 50 pound rescue packs on our backs. So pretty grueling walk out. We met a whole nother group of rangers coming up, probably about like, you know, 2,500 feet coming down Wittenberg that split the load up. But, you know, it was one of those nights where I got rolling to the house at midnight, 1 a.m. My wife, you know, expected me home at 4. And, you know, it's like, what did you get into today? And just a memorable one for me. I think I look back at missions like that, and you stack up a 17-year career. It's just, you know, you do a dozen of those a year. You just end up with this huge memory bank of like these awesome incidents where you got to rely on these guys you work with for everything. You know, like if I didn't know those pilots as well as I did, we would never have done that. If I didn't trust that state police SWORD operator to lower me in, we wouldn't have been able to pull that off. If I didn't get two really strong, super athletic guys lowered in to help me wheel him down that mountain, we wouldn't have been able to pull that off. And just get that overwhelming sense of gratitude to be able to work professionally to help people out like that. I never take for granted. It's like, even just these little ones where someone's flashlight dies or they're trying to walk out with their cell phone dies. And, you know, they're lost to the world. They're at 3,000 feet and they don't know where they are and they're scared. And it's the scariest moment of their life. And just going up and giving them a headlamp and walking them out, it's like a life-changing experience for some people. And it's just a overwhelmingly gratifying feeling to be involved in things like that. It's I couldn't ask for more job satisfaction.
Nice. Wow. Crazy. I think, to be honest, we were on standby for that one. We were sitting down, I believe, down in Phoenicia, right outside of the Phoenicia Lodge, waiting to do the carry out on that one. And that was pretty intense. And I didn't know the full story. So thank you for the full story. That's some crazy stuff. Martin, what about you, sir? What sticks in your head?
Yeah. So over 10 years, I've been racking my brain over a good notable one. A lot of the ones that stick with me as crazy or super challenging are oftentimes ones that end in a fatality, which might not make for the best story. I'll take us out of the Catskills here. It was a couple of years ago before COVID, so more than a couple of years ago, I got called up to the Whiteface ski area for a gentleman that had gone missing from the ski slope. It's the only time in my career the dispatch asked me if I had a set of skis. And when I said yes, they wanted to clarify and make sure they were downhill skis and not cross country or backcountry. The gist of the search was that this gentleman had gone missing from his ski group. At the end of the day, he was nowhere to be found, and his wallet and phone were in his hotel room. He had not taken them with him out to ski that day. We put a couple days, 3-4 days into searching for him. We're doing drone flights everywhere. We've got tracked vehicles up, down, and all around that mountain. Crews with avalanche prods working some of the most treacherous terrain. The mountain is still open. People are still recreating, but we've got the better part of 100 searchers there working hard daylight hours and then flying infrared at night trying to find this guy. And all of a sudden, he decides to make a call to his wife. He had somehow come into possession of a new cell phone and had somehow found himself in California. The story to this day has never fully come out. We can all make assumptions about what happened. But I remember that as being one hell of a story. The effort that went into it, the stress to family and friends. Without getting too far into the guy's history, he was a member of an organization that was pretty significant, and that organization had sent down a bunch of resources to help look for him. Lake Placid as a community had opened up their hotels at much cheaper rates to put people up, to put rangers up at state rate during the height of the skiing season. And all of these people were working in concert to look for someone that Indonesia or something to care about, but maybe not. So, that's one that sticks for sure.
Yeah, I remember hearing about that. That was a crazy incident. And I've been looking to get somebody on here to talk about that, because maybe the guy to be like, you know, what the hell happened? You were up on Whiteface Mountain skiing and all of a sudden you're gone and then you're up in California.
Well, as I understand it, and I won't dig too far into speculation or what my foggy memory recalls, but I do believe that he submitted to interrogation and spoke to state police investigators. As I understand it, he stuck with his story that he had a head strike and that some amnesia had resulted, and he somehow hopped on a tractor trailer and ended up in California. I think that it would be a public service if you bought this guy a few beers and pumped him for info.
Yeah, I will. If you can get me a name, I will do that. I will find him. So what about your favorite place in the Catskills? Let's say favorite hike in the Catskills. How about that?
Yeah, we saw that question and we decided we wanted to give you number 15 on the list, but the 14 above that we got to keep secret.
Hell yeah, hell yeah. What's number 15 then?
Number 15. No, I think my favorite hike has got to be Slide Mountain. I just how much bigger it is than the other peaks. I don't know. It's got a place in my heart. I hope I'm still walking up that as an 89-year-old man. But yeah, I'm a big hunter. So, you know, the ridges I'll go hunt near and dear to my heart. Like I said, we do a lot off trail. So, man, you could just run into some really cool, unique spots when you get back in there. And yeah.
Cool.
I don't think you can go wrong on any peak and slide wilderness.
There's always a view to be had.
Yeah. Martin, how about you?
I will say that, you know, being mostly honest here, and anybody that tries to attempt this, you got to make sure you know what you're doing. But I've always loved Ashokan High Point. The department put a pretty sizable parking lot in there as it's become more popular. There is a viewpoint that you can find off of Ashokan High Point on a peak called Little Ashokan High Point. That is an incredibly picturesque location. At this moment in time, the vegetation on this relatively bald area is still pretty much intact because nobody has spoken about it on podcasts yet. if you find yourself there during like migration season for raptors, because you're right on the edge of the Hudson River Valley, it is absolutely an amazing spot to sit with a pair of binoculars. It's east facing. It's just a very beautiful location. It's a long hike. I will say that Open Space Institute owns a chunk of that land. It is currently posted, but your listeners should keep an eye out in the coming years. At some point, the plan is for that piece of land to transition fully to the department. Right now, the boundary runs right through the viewpoint, so you can lawfully access it. But the remainder of it will hopefully come to the state sooner rather than later.
I agree. That is a very awesome spot. But once again, that hike is like over 9 miles long. So be freaking prepared. There's also a plane crash off of Ashokan High Point.
I've always been told there's two. I found the one that's on the red loop that's pretty scattered at this point.
Yeah.
But I have coordinates I got to make it out to when the leaves come off. For a supposedly second plane crash out there. But that's just a beautiful mountain, a beautiful area, you know, with a little bit of leaves off trees, you know, a good autumn hike. There's a lot of really cool views to be had up there, a lot of wildlife.
Damn straight. Historic as well when you're going up it too, the cairns and stuff. Let me know about that that time you want to hike for that plane crash, because me and Joe, of course, you know, we love plane crashes, so we'll go help you. It'd
be a lot of fun. I'm always finding and hearing about more. People have done far more research than I have with old newspapers and the like to track these things down, but they are pretty special to find.
Awesome. I love I call it the knob. I love that hike. That's a great spot. So last question. Well, second to last question. Any advice you want to give to the listeners?
Carry a headlamp.
Yes, thank you. Definitely a decent headlamp that has batteries brand freaking new.
You gotta have batteries, and you should probably have a backup too, but you know, no joke, you know, talking about people overexerting themselves, biting off more than they can chew, having that momentary panic. At the end of the day, so much comes down to whether you have light or not.
Yeah.
I think my advice, you know, the citizens of New York, you know, we've got this tremendous gift that previous generations have given us of this, you know, these giant chunks of state land that belong to us. And, you know, we as a department, you know, we try to be pretty permissive and, you know, you can go out and enjoy where you want to enjoy. My advice is, you know, get a map and explore some of those harder to get spots. You know, you'll get a very different experience just getting a little bit off the beaten path, and, it's a very different experience. Certainly don't think you should start out that way, but you know, if you really want to enjoy some of these areas for what they are, do yourself a favor and spend some time off trail. Pick a ridge you want to check out, a stream you want to walk. There's just some beautiful stuff out there that you're not going to find or see on a marked path.
Correct. And like I said, a lot of the people on this are probably, like, not, I wouldn't say avid hikers, but most of them general their general knowledge of hiking. So great advice. And I got to agree with you. You know, I've been off trail and I have found some stuff I've never thought I would seen before, especially, you know, over in the Peak of Moose area, the Slide Mountain area. I've been off trail so much over there. And I got to admit, the stuff I see is the crap I would never thought I would see ever again. And it's so cool. So last question. Post-hike brews and bites, what do you suggest for your favorite place to go get a beer or something to eat after, you know, a hike or a rescue mission or a long day for you guys, basically?
The Slide Mountain area is awash in ritzy resorts. I would send your listeners to the Slide Mountain Inn, a small bar that looks like it's straight out of the early 1900s. it is changing and will continue to change, but it used to be full of taxidermy and paintings by a relative of the owner. It has a tiny little bowling alley where you have to set up your own pins.
Oh, nice.
Like this old arcade that feels straight out of the Borscht Belt. And then a huge helping of German beers and German food, courtesy of the proprietor's, I believe, mother. The place, again, will change with time and would certainly change if the number of people going there skyrocketed. But it's a wonderful place. Great beer. And it's in such a picturesque area right down there on Olivia Road.
Nice.
Rock their on. Hours are very limited. I think they probably already shut down for the year.
Hey, what about you, Slade?
I'm going to underwhelm your listeners here again. I'm not as cultured as Martin is here. The ongoing joke with me is that I've always got a couple Stewart's wrappers in my front seat. I live one gas station at a time.
Nice. Well, hey, whatever. What about Snyder's Tavern? Have you guys ever been there? Have you ever heard of that great place?
I live very, very close to there. I think that is one of the best places around. When I moved to the community 7 years ago, that was one of my first stops. And I met Chet, the owner, that day. It was a quiet afternoon on a weekend. Nobody else was there yet. I'm always blown away by how friendly the clientele is. And how in an area that is awash in city people, second homes and the like, you can go there and still have a local experience. So yeah. Very cool place. You've been, I assume?
Oh, yeah. That's where me and my friend Joe have gotten most of our plane crash information.
Interesting. Yeah, the place, it's definitely a repository of local knowledge there.
Yeah. So,
great spot.
Place looks like the outside looks like the Addams Family House.
It's it's a little rough around the edges, but with that comes a bunch of history and cheap beer.
Yes, agreed. So excellent. Thank you guys for joining me on the show. I really appreciate you taking your time out and speaking on the show. And once again, we appreciate for what you guys do. Yeah. So thank you to the monthly supporters. Thank you to everyone who has donated. Thank you to the sponsors for sponsoring the show. Everyone who has believed in me in 94 episodes and still listening is crazy. Didn't think I'd ever go this long and didn't think I'd ever get a chance to talk with my two Forest Rangers, Slade and Martin, who has trained me multiple times in search and rescue incidents and stuff like that. Thanks for joining me tonight, guys. I hope you have a great night. Let's get together on the trail.
I hope this can be a regular event. Thank you.
Hell yeah.
Appreciate having us on. And yeah, anytime, let us know. We'll come back. Hear about a good story. You want the skinny on, we'll give you what we can. Or, you get a list of viewer or listener questions answered right from the Ranger's mouth. We're happy to do that for you.
Awesome. Thanks for joining, guys. Have a good night.
Take care.
Yep.
Hey guys, I just want to thank you for listening to the show. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe and throw down a smooth review on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or any podcast platform that you use. You can also check daily updates of the podcast, hikes, hiking memes, and local news on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and the official website of the show. Remember this, you just keep on living, man. L-I-V-I-N.
Wicked, 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 wicked.